February 22nd at the Nimoy, the globally acclaimed Grenadian-Jamaican-American artist examines stuttering, justice, blackness, disabled speech, and divinity in this arresting reflection on the human experience. Tickets at cap.ucla.edu.
You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles.
Good afternoon and welcome to Middle East in Focus. I'm Negwa Ibrahim. On December 12th of 2024, the Biden administration released the first ever national strategy to counter Islamophobia and anti-Arab hate. However, as Nadia Ahmed writes in her most recent op-ed, quote, "The document is a moral obscenity that should insult the intelligence and dignity of every self-respecting person of conscience in America. The breathtaking hypocrisy of releasing this document while U.S.-funded bombs obliterate Palestinian civilians in Gaza defies comprehension," end quote. She goes on to further state that, quote, "the document pretends to address Islamophobia while carefully preserving every system that perpetuates it," end quote. With us today to discuss the Biden administration's release of the first ever national strategy to counter Islamophobia and anti-Arab hate is our guest, Nadia Ahmed, author, environmental justice advocate, climate data scientist, and law professor at Barry University School of Law. She's also the co-founder of Muslim Delegates and Allies Coalition and a 2020 DNC national delegate from Orlando, Florida. Welcome, Nadia Ahmed, to Middle East in Focus.
Thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. And I very much appreciated your op-ed, and I'm you know, very honored to have you on the show and to really bring to light some of the disturbing hypocrisies within the document, as you very profoundly pointed out in your op-ed. Before we get into how the document, the National Strategy to Counter Islamophobia and Anti-Arab Hate, is, as you describe it, a moral obscenity and insult to victims of U.S. policy, can you just first outline for us what the document says and what is its supposed purpose?
Yeah, and so I think what they did is, and what I think is so problematic is at the beginning of it, like the introduction section, they mark the anniversary in the passage of the bill or the resolution that is relating to the death of a 6-year-old Palestinian American boy named Wadi Al Fayoumi, and it's really like they're using that an example for one American boy that was killed in the United States, and really they're using that as cover to this entire genocide, when if you look at it today, even the perpetrators behind that heinous action have still not been brought to justice. And so even in the first sentence of it, you know, it's just lip service. And in the sentence that you had just quoted, I really wanted to highlight that, because when I first wrote it, I was actually going to say for self-respecting Muslims. But when I thought about it more broadly, it should be anybody of conscience that thinks about it. And so the way that they frame this, what they call the U.S. National Strategy to Counter Islamophobia and Anti-Arab Hate, it's really looking to look at what exactly are the specifics. And it's really, generally, it would be a welcome document, but the way that it has been released, and also how it's providing cover to this genocide, in a way that it was also, it was designed especially by a number of Muslim and Arab American organizations who were part of the drafting and the consultation process. To the extent that they had a way to do it, this is a follow-up from their previous anti-Semitism policy that was put forward. And so last year, in 2023, the Biden Harris administration released the national strategy to combat anti-Semitism. And so, but then there was no corresponding strategy. So this document is a follow-up from that. And the way they frame it around is the hate that grew after September 11th, but then really ignoring everything that has happened since then. And all these commitments that were put in place just really ring hollow.
So I want to get now into the specifics around some of the solutions proposed in the document and how much of it, as you point out, is a breathtaking hypocrisy. I really appreciate how direct you were in your op-ed about the document. So I'm going to do another quote of yours. Also, how it was just a grotesque attempt at laundering the reputation of the administration. So with that, can you talk about specifically how the release of this document was those things, this breathtaking hypocrisy and this grotesque attempt at laundering the reputation of the administration? And why do you think the administration chose now to release it as it's sort of outgoing and then what we have incoming with the Trump administration?
Yeah, and so the document itself is built on four specific pillars, and those include promoting public awareness and education about these communities, as well as enhancing their safety and security, as well as combating systemic discrimination and encouraging cross-community solidarity. And so all that seems fine on paper, and it's supposed to foster inclusivity and ensure the safety of Muslims and Arabs. But really, in practice, the document is just so infuriating because it's really high on rhetoric and very low on meaningful action. And when we kind of look at the different contradictions, like going through even page by page, line by line of the document, that the administration says it wants to combat Islamophobia. And on the other hand, it continues supporting policies that actively harm Muslim communities, not only overseas, but even in the United States, through surveillance programs and watch lists and different types of racial profiling. And you noted as well, like the time period as well. So they had 4 years in office and they didn't want to do anything about it then. And this has been an ongoing process. It's not as if somebody sat down on some cold December day and said, oh, you need to do this. They've actually been working in consultation with a number of organizations. I've seen up lists where it shows up to 50 different organizations that have been allegedly part of this consultation process, to the extent that they've actually had a way to have meaningful input, that I'm not sure about. But I do know that that when they were drafting the document together, it happened to really correspond when there was an intensity and conflict in Gaza, and also around the time that the political scientists have also noted that there's a correlation between a heightened Islamophobia and political targeting that happens around election seasons. And so you have the U.S. backing, which even to this moment of military actions in Gaza against the Palestinians by Israel, it has really just devastated. I can't even really think and to describe the scope as what has happened there. But then you come back home and you look at all these discriminatory surveillance programs of mosques that have remained intact, combating hate, when those same policies essentially perpetuate it. And also, a lot of critics have also seen this strategy as the PR move to really distract from those systemic harms.
And I will, we'll do it in a second, because I don't know if, you know, folks are fully aware of the type of systemic harms that continue to be in place that are very much deeply rooted in anti-Muslim racism. So we'll get into some of those specifics. But before we do that, I wanted to ask you about actually something you just said, that supposedly there were 50 different orgs that were allegedly a part of the consultation. Do you by chance know if any of those 50 orgs have made any statements with respect to the final document that was released, and any comments by those orgs regarding it?
I don't, I don't know, because the document doesn't state the organizations in there, because I think the organizations don't maybe want to be identified as such. But I do know some of the organizations that at some point been involved in the consultation process have issued statements in some way saying that the document falls short. But my thing was that why would they even participate in that entire process if they weren't going to really hold the line on the issues? And really, I think that it's really camouflaging the problems. And I think it also brings us to some of the bigger questions about how we really want to engage with government and politics, with the media, and to what extent are we really really being able to speak freely. And there's also what we've seen, especially, I'd say really over the past few decades, just high levels of censorship from all sorts of people, all sorts of organizations, where they may be censored, but then they also engage in self-censoring as well, because they know the limits of what they can say and can't say. And what this document does, and by engaging in that consultation process and saying that, you know, religious and ethnic communities are really part of this national strategy, is that it really doesn't help with capacity building to really do what the document says it's going to do, is to protect individuals and communities from bias, discrimination, and hatred.
So I want to get to another point that you raise in your piece, and if you can maybe elaborate a little bit more. You talked about how the national strategy actually gaslights Muslim communities. Can you talk about how it specifically gaslights Muslim communities?
And I'll speak about that just from my own experience, especially working within the Democratic Party, is that you'll have a seat at the table, but it won't do anything if you don't have any decision-making capacity. And I think that a lot of times we're trying to get a seat at the table when really all we should be trying to do is flip that table. And we haven't gotten there because over the past several decades, it's over, you know, quite a bit of time, is that we haven't learned from how meek our community is, like among like Muslims, Arabs, Palestinians, is that we have not built up political power. And so we need to do grassroots coalition building with other groups to really amplify what power we have. And I think that that's something that is essentially a skill, but it also requires people to go, and organizations to go outside of their comfort zone and really look back at what has happened in U.S. history, whether it's with the farm workers movement or even immigration rights movements and civil rights movement. We need to look at the history of this country and see how things changed. And it didn't happen by sitting around at the White House and asking them to change policy.
I really love what you just said, that, you know, really it's, you know, for folks within Muslim communities and folks outside of Muslim communities that are dedicated to ensuring systemic equality, that it isn't about trying to get a seat at the table. I really love that. I just want to remind everyone that we are talking today about the Biden administration's release of the first ever national strategy to counter Islamophobia and anti-Arab hate with our guest, Nadia Ahmed, author, environmental justice advocate, climate data scientist, and law professor at Barry University School of Law. She's also the co-founder of Muslim Delegates and Allies Coalition and a 2020 DNC national delegate from Orlando, Florida. You know, one of the things you bring up in your piece is discussions by the ACLU regarding this document, the National Strategy to Counter Islamophobia and Anti-Arab Hate. And you quote Hina Shamsi of the ACLU, who says, quote, "For decades, American officials have invoked national security to pass laws and implement programs that disproportionately harm Muslims and people perceived to be Muslim," end quote. And then you go on to point out how this national strategy to counter Islamophobia and anti-Arab hate does not, quote, "actually dismantle programs, not one," end quote. And as you've also been bringing up in our conversation now, I now want to get into some of the specifics around these oppressive programs. Can you outline some of them and provide some examples of how these programs have harmed and actually continue to harm Muslims and people perceived to be Muslim? And again, doing this at a very systemic level.
Right. And if we go back in time a little bit, there was a program called Countering Violent Extremism, and it was abbreviation was known as CVE. And so this really stigmatizes Muslim communities as being inherently suspicious just by the way that it was created. And so these surveillance programs specifically target mosques and individuals are thought to be active in terms of breeding trust, distrust. The administration is putting in place, and this is done at mosques. I mean, if you talk to imams, and I've talked to a number of imams, they're scared even in terms of when they speak in the masjid, because they say, oh, you know, there's people in the classroom, I mean in the congregation that are listening in to what we're saying. And so they're concerned that even if they're saying something that isn't improper, that it's going to be contorted, that it'll be used against them in a way that it may be taken out of context. And so I think that really creates and breeds a system of fear, and then that really flows across in other sectors. And it also impacts donors as well, like the mosque of the board of the mosque, as well as those who are really, you know, working and doing active volunteer work, is that it really has this really pervasive impact. And at the same time, you see people who are being impacted by the military support for oppressive regimes, namely Israel, as well as those in Muslim majority countries. And then you also have the issues relating to drone strikes. And so there's a big disconnect between having an Islamophobia policy when the state policy is essentially built on anti-Muslim bias. And the government's just saying in this document, hey, we're on your side, when their actions are just telling a completely different story. And I'll give you another example of an Islamophobic policy, which is the military prison in Guantanamo Bay. This prison was set up after 9/11. The detainees had many of them did not have any charges brought before them, and they were essentially handed over by other governments. Many of them were, you know, taxi drivers, shopkeepers, bookkeepers, and really were at the wrong place at the wrong time. And there was bounties that were put to capture these terrorists, or alleged terrorists, in this march up to the Iraq War. And so many of these people had their lives disrupted and are still held there. And the way that the entire court system was brought down and set up was a completely unfair. And if you look at the case specifically of Muhammad Oud Salahi, who wrote the Guantanamo Diary and later had his story filmed into a motion picture, he really wrote his way out of Guantanamo Bay, which is quite remarkable because he didn't even know English. And so I think that really goes and shows you the testament to the power of human will, and also showing that despite everything the government has done, it hasn't really been able to quell the spirit of Islam.
And I think, you know, what you're bringing up, and correct me if I'm wrong, that really what we see is various policies within the United States, both in terms of domestic policy as well as U.S. foreign policy, where there is this basically presumption of guilt based on someone's identity as a Muslim, and that conflation of terrorism with someone's identity as a Muslim, and all Muslims being presumed to be quote unquote terrorists, and then denied their rights based on these ridiculous and racist presumptions. And we see that, as you describe, sort of play out in different ways where that's actually legalized despite the fact that this is truly unlawful. And, you know, as you're talking about with respect to Guantanamo, I think, and we talk about Guantanamo quite a bit on this show, but I think it's really recognizing that what we had in Guantanamo is individuals who were not charged with the crime being held indefinitely, literally legalized lawlessness. And all of these individuals were Muslims. And really what you see, I think, you know, and I've talked about it on this show, is essentially like a concentration camps of Muslims and people being put there for no other reason but the fact that they were Muslim. And so, you know, I think that what you're describing and what we're talking about is really how this national strategy to counter Islamophobia and anti-Arab hate, while it's talking about addressing discrimination against Muslims, what you've just described is how simultaneously, though, in no way is it trying to actually address these governmental systems that have been and continue to perpetuate systemic discrimination against Muslims. So in addition to that being what is so hypocritical about the document, can you also talk about how the release of this national strategy is particularly, as you say, quote, repugnant, the timing of it?
Yeah, I mean, the timing is just really isn't an accident. The strategy was essentially dropped, like, you know, in the waning days of the Biden administration, while you have escalating violence that is happening, perpetrated by Israel in Gaza. And the U.S. has continued to provide U.S. military and political support for these actions that has caused up to 300,000 deaths, according to a recent journal article in The Lancet. And I think just, you know, you have the show based in California. And if you just look at the scope of the wildfires that have just happened, the Biden administration just sent over another $8 billion to Israel. This money could be used to fight fires better, as well as to provide housing to all these people who have been displaced. And I think that this is really a moral stain on the U.S., and it's something that it won't be able to really recover from. And so by releasing this document so late in the game, it really feels like it's a calculated move to pacify not really address the issue, but really to pacify domestic Muslim communities. So they have something to show that, oh, you know, we actually did something during this administration, while really ignoring the suffering of Muslims abroad. And I think that we can't fall into the trap as Muslims in the U.S. between us versus them, like us in the U.S. Like, you know, that's happening overseas. I don't think we should do that because I think it's really, really offensive to kind of allow that separation to happen.
So now I want to get into some of the specific solutions or, you know, supposed solutions that the document proposed. Can you maybe give us some examples of proposed solutions that the document presents to address basically anti-Muslim racism and how these, you know, proposed solutions are actually an insult to basic intelligence? So can you give us some of those specifics?
Okay, I'll give you one example. One of them has to do with Strategic Goal 3.5 says that it's going to provide appropriate accommodations for religious dietary needs and federally funded feeding programs, federal prisons, and other settings. So this is quite interesting because there's actually a population because Muslims are targeted more and end up going to prison or prosecuted more because of their Muslimness. And if I'll give you an example in Florida, the prison population, 10% is Muslim, and Muslims only constitute 1% or less than 1% of the population in Florida. So does that mean Muslims are committing more crimes? No, it just means that they're being targeted more for imprisonment. So one of these goals of the Islamophobia strategy is to make sure that they can have essentially halal meals. Maybe a better strategy would not be to imprison them more and to allow for a better carceral system that doesn't allow for this broader sense of mass incarceration. Another policy is related to continue to expand and mobilize multi-faith partnerships. So this is problematic. It looks good on its face, but what essentially has happened is the state decides, as well as the broader civil society, like this another us versus them dichotomy between the good Muslims versus the bad Muslims. And so a lot of these multi-faith partnerships, when they occur, they essentially use this paradigm of the moderate Muslim, the moderate Muslim who doesn't engage in radical Islam. And it really essentially is also done as a normalizing project to normalize Arab relations with Israel, and also to normalize Muslim-Jewish faith partnerships with kind of overlooking, again, the genocide and apartheid that is happening in Palestine.
So now let's move into what should this national strategy to counter Islamophobia. I mean, you just sort of mentioned some just now in talking about the solutions they do present and how those are not real solutions and what are examples of what a real solution would look like. Can you outline even in more detail what would be needed for this national strategy to counter Islamophobia and anti-Arab hate? What would it need to have to even have some basic credibility?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that it should do is as a basic step, is to really dismantle immediately all these discriminatory surveillance programs. But that's not going to happen because there's a whole surveillance state apparatus with big tech, as well as like the prison industrial complex, to really allow for these surveillance programs to continue. Another one of those is to end these racist watch list programs. That also is something that they aren't going to do because, again, these are all like industries. Like, there's money tied into it. So for them to get rid of those industries, they aren't going to do that because it's really been kind of baked into the system. Another thing that I think would be helpful is to really provide reparations to these communities that have been devastated by post 9/11 policies, not just in the U.S. but overseas. We have a sense of reparations for slavery that's been moving through the California legislature for providing reparations for slavery. And so I think we should also be talking about reparations for communities that have been impacted by 9/11 policies, especially by the false imprisonment and this targeted surveillance. And I think another good point to really have to really be truthful and respectful on Islamophobia policy would be to really stop arming governments that massacre Muslims, and to just have the U.S. follow its own laws. The U.S. has laws that are put in place called the Leahy Laws. These Leahy Laws condition any types of military aid or funding that is provided to adherence to human rights. We know this has not been done neither by Israel or even by Saudi Arabia. So that's just something that needs to also happen to really have a true Islamophobia policy. And just because those who are being killed happen to be Muslim doesn't mean we need to stop enforcing these human rights laws. I think it would also be important to make sure that anyone who has enabled these types of officials, who have enabled this type of discrimination to occur, to be held accountable. Journalist Sam Husseini, who was at Secretary Tony Blinken's last press briefing, was essentially hauled out by multiple security officials when he was trying to ask a question. And really, they want to have a genocide and then have nobody question them either. So I think we need to have questions. And it's important to recognize that the Biden administration, especially Anthony Blinken and Joe Biden themselves, needs to be held accountable before the International Criminal Court and the International Court of Justice. And they should really end U.S. support for Israel.
This is Middle East in Focus, and we have been talking today about the Biden administration's release of the first ever national strategy to counter Islamophobia and anti-Arab hate with our guest, Nadia Ahmed, author, environmental justice advocate, climate data scientist, and law professor at Barry University School of Law. She's also the co-founder of Muslim Delegates and Allies Coalition and a 2020 DNC national delegate from Orlando, Florida. Thank you so much, Professor Ahmed, for joining us today.
Yeah, it's my pleasure to be here. And it's just really unfortunate that we're living in a time that we're not even recognized as human.
Absolutely. And we'll end there. You've been listening to Middle East in Focus. Again, the only reason you can hear this show is because all of you, the audience, support us, tune in every week, and continue to support us financially to allow us to truly be independent radio. We thank you and hope you'll keep listening and continue to support us. Our theme song is the overture from Summer Night's Dream by Marcel Felipe. I want to thank our fantastic engineer, Ozzy. Thank you all, listeners, and for KPFK Los Angeles.